Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 16th of May, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we'll be joined today by live video Skype link by Alex Thompson of Eastern Approaches. Well, the prize goes to Norfolk, where I believe it is sunny. So well done.
Apologies for the slight delay there. We had an internet glitch right before the programme, and it's hard to say whether that was North Korea or Russia that was responsible for that.
I would have thought both, Mike.
Both.
Probably working in collaboration.
Okay, so where are we starting then?
Well, we're really just going to give this a brief mention because tomorrow we will have David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives with us, and we're going to have an in-depth look at the sheer lies that the Conservative Party, and in particular Michael Fallon, are coming out with. This is the headline: Defence Secretary Michael Fallon blocks plans to create a headquarters for an EU army. This is just astonishing, Mike, because of course they haven't blocked anything. You put up the little video clip of Boris Johnson saying, well, we've got to be very careful with the language. Well, of course, the Conservatives have got to be careful with the language, because EU military unification has been going ahead at pace, driven with the full support of the Tory party. Now the truth is coming out. They're trying to massage wording in order to hide the fact that EU military unification has been going ahead. So playing with the words, but we know what's happening behind the scenes, and we'll be having an in-depth look tomorrow. So join us for that particular specialist area. We'll just remind people, of course, it was the UK column back in April 2016 that was warning that EU military integration had gone so far that British defences were simply going to be taken apart as the next step. And it was the UK column, and only the UK column, that started to warn that the EU military HQs in St Morgan, but also Northwood in London, had been established and could be activated in just 24 hours, completely removing any semblance of British sovereignty. So I think we're going to have an extremely interesting session with David Ellis, having a look at that tomorrow.
Let's bring Alex in at this point. Alex, Parliament some time ago, April this was, but we've been trying to discuss this for a couple of weeks. United Nations Sustainable Development Goals debate in the House of Lords. Tell us what was going on there.
This was one of those debates, Mike, which was snuck in or sandwiched in before Parliament was suspended. It was on the 26th of April, and it was the 3:22 p.m. debate in the Lords. And a question was put by Lord McConnell to ask HMG what action they plan to take to deliver the UN's global goals for sustainable development by 2030. Now, this is the successor to Agenda 21, of course, for those who are aware of that iteration of the plan. So what Lord McConnell is asking is, how is Her Majesty's government going to implement a global and globalist agenda, even regardless of EU or national government? Because a lot of this goes down to local so-called community and council levels. And so the Minister of State, as usual in the Lords, was the first to respond, and that's Lord Bates. I think you have an indication of his previous post here. Oh, no, that's his speech. OK, fair enough. But I will mention in passing that his previous role was the Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for Criminal Information.
Yes.
And when he was doing that role up until 2015, he was responsible for big data, basically things like disclosure, criminal records, criminal information systems, safeguarding vulnerable people, something that the UN and a lot of ex-council people now involved in tech companies are very, very interested in, databases of where the vulnerable children, adults and mentally impaired and elderly live. So that's Bates' responsibility. And, of course, in his portfolio, he had the UN's old chestnut, equality and diversity. But now he's gone on to be the Minister of State at DFID, the Department for International Development. Now, as UK column has been highlighting for a while, DFID has grown. I personally saw it in 2003 start to take its seat at the Joint Intelligence Committee and in the expert level meetings that lead up to that. And I actually personally handwrote the sign in the cabinet office for DFID, because I thought if these people are sitting at the table, they need a sign. So I saw that literally being born, DFID having a seat at the big table. Then we get interesting responses. The Minister of State himself said that the government's firmly committed to delivering the global goals. In other words, we have a government and a cross-party cabal working on behalf of the UN. And there's a follow-up question by the Labour Lord who put it, which is obviously him having putting his oar in, having his two penny worth. Then we have the Liberal Democrat, Baroness Sheehan, talking about illicit money flows and insisting that we must have public registers of beneficial ownership, which is very much the agenda, again, of we must know who owns what in the world at a world level. Some people call this global tax, but it's more like global registration of individuals. If you look at Bernice Bartel's articles on our site recently, you'll find out more about that. Then a crossbencher, Lord Alton of Liverpool, talking about embezzlement of DFID money in South Sudan, and in a matter which we've talked about repeatedly on the UK column. Are we actually aggravating the problem in their areas of famine? Another Labour Lord spoke about inequalities. And then I think what you have on screen or had on screen there was the intervention by the Lord Bishop of Southwark, Mike. Did you have that?
No. That what you thought was that was Linda's intervention.
OK, then. Well, interestingly enough, what happened was that the Lord Bishop of Southwark, for our foreign viewers who are growing, we have 24 bishops in the House of Lords, the Lord's spiritual. You know, some people talk about 24 blackbirds baked in a pie. We have 24 bishops baked in the House of Peers. And the Lord Bishop of Southwark said it's very, very important that we use small organisations and he mentioned the Arab world, particularly Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza. And speaking on behalf of the Church of England, because they always do when they speak in the House, he was saying that the CEV is very interested in small organisations in the Arab world getting lots of government coming basically from Her Majesty's government to reprogram local government and make it global and sustainable. So a lot of very interesting things going on in that debate.
Then tell us about the communication you had with Linda Lauderdale then related to this.
Yes, Linda Lauderdale is, and I checked with her, she doesn't mind us saying it, she was a former electoral registrations officer in one of the councils. And she points out that when she read this, it made her think of other aspects of the government's use of big data, which were not immediately apparent to people. I don't know whether you had her words, Mike, or otherwise we'll talk about them.
Yes, we do.
Yes, so, here we are.
So she says, one of my local government jobs was electoral registration and elections. Electoral registration forms were posted to all households. The only qualifying date was the 10th of October of a given year. But now there's a rolling register allowing people to register all year. Where no forms were returned, reminders would be posted. Still no response would result in a personal call from canvassers. Even then, I was loath to delete anyone from the register. And if the unresponsive household was active in other areas, such as refuse collection and council tax, I would carry over their names into the next year. So people had at least three instances per year where they could complete the form, in addition to public notices and the draft registers. And then she goes on to say, under the Electoral Registration Pilot Scheme, Order 2017. Now, of course, that's secondary legislation, Alex. It's a statutory instrument. It's not an Act of Parliament. So under that Order 2017, however, which is being sneaked in before this surprise parliamentary election, Article 5 requires electoral registration officers in the pilot areas to do the following, according to the government's own wording, to canvass each residential area address in the area for which they act at least once, but the manner in which they do so and whether they take further steps where no information is received in respect of a particular address will be at the electoral registration officer's discretion. And she goes on to say, it's quite a task and takes a good few months of the year, printing, postage, canvassers' wages and keeping councillors out of your office. Imagine if one wanted to save time and funds and give people only one chance of registering the right to vote in our so-called free elections. And if councils wanted to use Facebook or Twitter to reach voters, people don't know they're only being given at least one chance in whatever way that chance is offered. They didn't know where they were being given three annual chances before. Those who fill in the forms on time don't know about reminders or visits. So this statutory instrument will go by unnoticed.
Right. So what Linda's putting her finger on here is that respectable, dare I say, to use shorthand, respectable middle class people who fill in every form that comes through their letterbox have no idea of the millions and millions of underclass people in the country, particularly in traditionally Labour voting areas, and also increasingly, I think, in nationalist voting areas in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And you could say the same about Green or minor party voting areas in England now. That people perhaps don't have an idea of how few forms are returned and how few knocks on the door by officials are answered in many of our estates and poorer areas, particularly the Labour heartlands. And I think that what we're seeing here is what David Ellis was getting at last week. And don't forget, David Ellis is involved in politics as an independent councillor. People have said, why didn't he stand for Parliament this time? But that's not his calling at this stage. But David Ellis knows the same as Linda here. The machine, and I wouldn't say it's the Tory party, but it has chosen the Tory party as its vessel. The machine, or the deep state, is quite adamant now that only the right people in the right areas will be aware of and be signed up for the election on time. You would be surprised, or you wouldn't personally, Mike, but a lot of people would be surprised how many people in the country barely know there's an election campaign at the moment. And that's not only because of the non-campaigning, it's even if they were allowed campaigning, a lot of people wouldn't bother, wouldn't know. And that suits the machine just fine. Basically, if you want a landslide election, you don't do it by, if that's Tory and Labour, right? So that's the classic position in England. The Tories are the party of natural party of government, particularly in England, because they're higher. Now, if you want a landslide, you can't do this. Massively increase the Tory vote unless you have a figurehead like Mrs. Thatcher who appeals to Middle England. Instead, what you can do is this, and suddenly you have a landslide, if you get my drift. You drop the Labour vote. A lot of people are not aware there's an election. I know that a lot of people enthused for Labour because of Corbyn and who joined because of Corbyn. But generally, the idea is depress and suppress the opposition vote. So David Ellis put his finger on it last week when he said the machine has decided to follow us all in real time, largely through social media, and finding out in which constituencies and which socioeconomic groups are talking and energised about the election, and just manipulate that in order to make sure that the right people turn out on the day to get the right results. I must stress, this is not Tory party as a party. It's the machine which has realised the Tory party, like the Republicans in the US, is the right vessel to use because it has the natural sympathy of the inbuilt majority.
And Alex, that machine then suppressing people's votes, but perhaps suppressing freedom of speech. And you tweeted this out. One of my good Irish friends on Twitter has just let me know in astonishment that Twitter told him that they'd had a complaint from him about you. He wasn't aware that he had made a complaint to Twitter, but there you go. And to follow up on that, we've been seeing an increasing number of comments on YouTube, people apparently being automatically unsubscribed from the YouTube channel for the UK column, and they don't really understand how this has happened. I've also seen people complaining that comments aren't appearing at all and so on. So, you know, there's quite a lot of this going on at the moment in a range of different areas.
Yes, and if we think we have it bad, Mike, then just look at the French, who've had their presidential election a couple of weeks, or last week, in fact. At the beginning of their electoral campaign, so in March, Facebook and Google, and I think Twitter, but particularly Facebook and Google in France, said that they were openly going to back Macron by getting so-called fake news spotters to suppress anything on social media that was pro-Le Pen or pro-facts about immigration. And as part of that campaign, of course, people just weren't aware of the Macron leaks because Macron said it's irresponsible journalism. And so that we've seen that openly happening. And to the extent that in the crucial weekend of the Macron leaks before the election on the Sunday, some people claim that thousands of individual pro-Le Pen Facebook groups were shut down or made invisible for the crucial period. And I think some of that's going on here. Dare I say it, even in a modest way, with UK Column. We know we're not a huge player, but we know that people of interest look at us and they're interested in what we do.
Well, it also explains then why certain people are able to run social media campaigns for the likes of Barack Obama and so on and do so quite so successfully, when there seems to be some kind of willingness by the social media companies to promote information from certain areas and to demote information from other areas. We're going to be coming back to this subject later on in the programme. But let's move on to Donald Trump then. So apparently, Alex, apparently Donald Trump has shared classified information with Russia. I've put the Irish Times article up, but this was originally blown by the Washington Post, apparently. It's an anonymous individual within the administration apparently has said this, citing current and former US officials. The Washington Post said Mr. Trump's shared details about an ISIS terror threat related to the use of laptop computers on aircraft with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. This, of course, is people are going nuts over it. Apparently, these are anonymous officials, so they haven't been named. They're not coming out of the woodwork. They told the Post that the information was relayed during an Oval Office meeting and that it had been provided by a US partner through an intelligence sharing arrangement. And then another unnamed official went on to tell BuzzFeed that the extent of this leak by the president is far worse than has already been reported. And of course, then what has happened? We've got legal experts, shall we say. This is the Lawfare website, legal experts coming out saying this is a disgrace, that Trump is in breach of his oath of office. He should be impeached. So we've got impeachment. And well, what I was interested in getting your thoughts on, Alex, what are the procedures with regard to so-called classified material and heads of state? Are they not entitled to use that for diplomatic purposes as they see fit?
That's absolutely right, Mike. Every country has different vetting procedures. Vetting is clearance to see secret information. But in every country, there are certain people who ex officio, by virtue and by dint of their role, must have full access to everything, or at least unimpeded access to anything relevant that crosses their path. And these include, in the British model, Privy Councillors, and if I'm not mistaken, Queen's Counsels, certainly Crown Court judges, and Her Majesty, and everyone in the royal line of succession, unless they do something to blot their copybook, which happened with the Wallis Simpson affair at the time the Joint Intelligence Committee was set up, because the King was leaving papers around for Mrs. Simpson's chums to gossip over. And they actually left wine glass stains on the document, so we knew that happened. But short of that, there are certain people, including certainly a president in any system, including the US, France and Russia, who have to know everything. Not that everything is briefed to them, but if they say, I want to know about that, they have a prima facie need to know, and to share with other heads of state, because at the top, diplomacy and intelligence fuse. That's the power of being the head of state or a head of government, is that you're in both of those roles. You're a diplomat and an intelligence digester. I mean, the White House is having a war at the moment between, obviously, the Trump core team and the old deep state people who can't stand him having been there. And a part of this is that there's White House staffers who set up silly accounts, you know, like the anti-Trump team within the White House. They tweet and Facebook ridiculous anti-Russian stuff in that capacity. And one of the things one of the games they played last week was they objected post factum, so after the fact, to the visit of a Russian photographer to the Oval Office, together with President Putin and Lavrov, the foreign minister. And the objection was that this man was double-hatted and that the Americans hadn't known that, as well as being a photojournalist, he also worked for the Russian state news agency TASS. And because of some White House list dating from eons ago, this apparently made him a threat, and he could have brought a bug within his camera into the Oval Office. I mean, this is the ridiculous level of what's going on here. And the Russians, of course, have seen right through it. Maria Zakharova said in an interview, these are the death throes of the US media, that they're engaging in such nonsense.
Yeah. Of course, Obama and the ex-Obama presidential campaign seems to be driving a lot of this rhetoric against Trump at the moment. And we've got a new player because Hillary Clinton is back in the game. And she set up this grassroots campaign, in inverted commas, called Onward Together. So it's a new group. She hopes to encourage people from all walks of life to get involved in politics. In other words, it's community organizing, Brian. And the website says it's dedicated to advancing the vision that earned nearly 66 million votes in the last election. Citizen engagement is at every level is central to a strong and vibrant democracy. In recent months, we've seen what's possible with people coming together to resist bullying, hate, falsehoods, divisiveness, and stand up for a fairer, more inclusive America. So we've got fairness coming in once again. Their slogan is resist, insist, persist, enlist. So that's great. I'm really impressed with that. But it's not just ex-presidents and ex-president campaigners that are doing this. It's the Turkish as well, Alex.
Yes, so I'm not sure which came first, but there is both a pro and an anti-Erdogan rally being organised in Lafayette Park, which is the nearest green space that people can turn up to the Capitol and the White House without being frisked to within an inch of their life. And what's happened, interestingly, this time is that now that Erdogan is no longer prime minister but president, and he's just, through his referendum, changed Turkey to a presidential republic. So he is the power man now in the presidential position. He is trying to turn out with muscle in the countries where he goes on visits. This is quite something because, it's entirely against protocol for a visiting head of state to ask for his loyalists to turn out in a rally. This is exactly what the Turkish ministers tried to do in Germany and the Netherlands in the run-up to the Turkish presidential constitutional change referendum, and which raised the ire of the Dutch and Germans, which are usually very placid toward the Turks, so much that we had these protests and riots that we covered at the time. And this is going a step further now with Turkish students, not just those, I think, on Turkish bursaries, but anyone who's on the list as at the Turkish embassy in Washington as a Turkish student in America, being told, turn up to Washington and Diyanet, the diaspora ministry for Turks abroad, which funds the mosques and so on, told them, well, if you're coming from out of town, we will bus you in and put you up for the night so that you can stand there cheering for Erdogan. I mean, the brass neck of this, at just the same time as the Germans have been told, you cannot go to Incirlik Air Base in southern Turkey near Syria. You cannot visit the Bundeswehr detachment there, serving German servicemen in that base, because Turkey says no. So they've got a completely wrong-headed attitude towards protocol and who calls the shots on what territory. Now, Turkey's becoming an extraterritorial state. It's becoming something like the old Chinese Empire, claiming the loyalty of every ethnic member of its own nationality anywhere in the world.
OK, well, quick advert for AV8, Ian Crane's AV8, which is taking place at the weekend. As we have been saying, all of the accommodation tickets have now gone. But if you'd like to attend on a day basis, tickets are still available and you can get those through Ian Crane's website. So encourage you to come if you've never been before. Very enjoyable, very sociable style of conference and event. And I'm sure that you will meet many other people who are interested in similar things, a good way of building up friendships. Well, we've talked about overseas issues. Let's come to something pretty fundamental at the heart of Westminster. And we've got policeman John Wedger, Metropolitan policeman, blew the whistle on the massive cover-up of child abuse by the British state, politicians, charities, local authorities, MPs. What has been happening? Well, we'll give you the latest, and that is that the Independent Police Complaints Commission that was supposed to be looking into his whistleblowing evidence has decided that, they're not going to bother. So if we summarise here, we've got no action from the Theresa May. Of course, British Prime Minister Theresa May said that she was going to fight for child abuse victims, but no action from her, no action from Home Secretary Amber Rudd, and now we've got no action from IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission Chair Dame Anne Owers, I beg your pardon. This is the Chief Operations Officer Ian Todd, so he's not doing anything either. No action from Cressida Dick, head of the Met, no action from Mike Penning, former policing minister, and no action from Brandon Lewis, the present policing minister. Now, what's becoming very interesting is that we've been receiving, we'll say word, allegations from people in Westminster and around Westminster that there's a desperation in the Conservative Party to cover up this political and establishment child abuse. And some people are saying that the pressure is so great that they called an election to make sure they could control any future debate on it in Westminster. Now, this at the moment is just an allegation, but I think it's an extremely interesting idea. And it's quite clear that pressure is building, because we know that a small group of cross-party MPs are now back on the case as to what's happening. Alex, what's your view? Do you think that this is just beyond the realms of possibility, or is the Conservative Party in deep trouble here?
The Conservative Party definitely is in deep trouble, because its last lot of loyal voters are basically Middle England baby boomers, and I understand that they cannot stomach voting for a far-left leadership of Labour, nor of the Lib Dems, because they regard that as an anti-British globalist party. I can understand these knee-jerks very well, and that there's not much else to vote for, to be frank. But I think we have to go with advocating Peter Hitchens' line. Well, he thinks the country's finished and lost now. I'm not quite as pessimistic as him. I couldn't bear to be. But his last political stance before he gave up political advice was that you should vote anyone but Tory. You must do anything you can to unseat the Tories, not because of an inherent left-wing bias, far from that with Peter Hitchens or indeed myself, but simply because if they have a supermajority, as even Carswell, the ex-MP for UKIP, is saying, having rejoined the Tories, which, you know, we must have a mega majority for May. If that happens, as you say, Brian, there will be complete shutdown of everything in Westminster, a flow of statutory instruments, domination of the peers as well. There will be no chance of getting this out through parliamentary channels, and that will drive the people, as their rage boils over about the pederocracy, onto the streets, which is the last thing we want, because then we'll have civil contingencies. So we can't have that. We must have good men and women in Parliament. We can't have them with the current control mechanism of any of the main parties. So it's vote anyone but Tory, I'm afraid. Hold your nose and vote Labour or Lib Dem or SNP or whatever. Just anything but to get rid of the Tories.
Thank you for that, and I would completely support that. I think the Tories at the moment, unbelievably dangerous, lies to the public on every subject. Let's just finish this little sequence. IPCC, I happened to notice this morning, they don't like talking to me on this particular subject, but apparently you can tweet your inquiry to them. So I'd like to encourage people who feel motivated in this incredible action. We know that IPCC, in investigating, spoke to a few people. And of course, the people they spoke to said, well, no, of course, we didn't do anything wrong. And IPCC apparently said, oh, well, thank you very much. And then they closed down the case. So no investigation equals no crime. I tweeted out this morning, IPCC has now closed down the case with no investigation and no interview of key witnesses. So others who feel they might like to get in contact with IPCC, this is an easy way of doing it. Have a look at the people and the backgrounds who are involved in this organisation. An amazing career progression here, from working on ambulances as a paramedic to the highest levels of government. It's quite astonishing. Perhaps he's an exceptional man. Here's the head lady, Dame Anne Owers. And what you discover, of course, is that she's fully accountable to the Home Secretary. So there's no independence in this organisation. And I'll just end on this, that apparently Amber Rudd has apparently been getting a bit of stick in her constituency because naughty people have been putting up graffiti saying evict Amber Rudd. But not to worry, because the police are investigating this. They can't investigate the child abuse in Westminster, but they can investigate graffiti. This is not amusing news. This is the state of UK at the moment, with a Conservative government desperate to cover up the paedophile networks around Westminster and obviously involved in the Conservative Party.
OK, let's talk artificial intelligence, so-called. So this is Chatham House's latest report. It's a research paper, Advancing Human Security Through Artificial Intelligence. They say that AI is one potential way to enable real-time, cost-effective and efficient responses to a variety of human security-related issues. So they say AI planning applications can quickly, reasonably and reliably enable users to carry out complex and multi-stage actions in disaster relief operations. The need for this capability is illustrated by the UN's average estimated response time for new peacekeeping missions. They say it's important to use normative principles to interrogate the purpose and effects of AI applications as they relate to empowerment and human security. AI is likely to disempower people as it is to empower them, so it's necessary to use ethical principles to guide the creation and deployment of AI systems. And they say that human security is not for the elite few, and so the capabilities of AI must be within everyone's grasp. Alex, what do you think of the chances that as we move along this AI agenda, that it is going to empower people and that it's going to be within everyone's grasp?
The chances of that are nil, Mike, because artificial intelligence in the form of androids was planned in, or foreseen in, science fiction as early as H.G. Wells in that wicked time of the 1870s, and certainly by the time of Isaac Asimov, the best sci-fi writer who turns out to have been, again, in the globalists' pay or in their circuit. He is foreseeing androids basically as serving the elite, and ultimately some genetic and moral questions arising, such as, you know, where does humanity begin and end? And in fact, do we end up being lesser than androids? Or do we start regarding artificial intelligence as having human rights? And all of these considerations have been framed for over 100 years along the lines of artificial intelligence being there to do the government's bidding, not to lighten the burden for the average man and woman, no.
Well, let's look a little bit more then at this issue, because this is DeepMind. DeepMind Technologies Limited, a British artificial intelligence company, founded in September 2010. It was bought by Google in 2014. It has created various types of neural network that learns to play video games just like humans, a neural network that might be able to access external memory, like similar to the way that humans access their short-term memory. But in 2016, in July 2016, it announced a collaboration between itself, DeepMind, and the Moorfields Eye Hospital. And of course, it was to apply artificial intelligence to the analysis of anonymized eye scans, apparently, searching for early signs of diseases leading to blindness. So this all sounds very good. But then there were two other projects announced, the Royal Free Hospital and Imperial College NHS Trusts, and they were to develop new clinical mobile applications linked to electronic patient records. And this partnership has finally reached some level of controversy. So there's the second NHS partnership mentioned. And today, Quartz has this article, and I suggest people go and read it. The headline is, "A leaked letter is battering DeepMind's argument that it stayed within health data privacy laws." And so basically, they have obtained, according to this article, 1.6 million patient records from the National Health Service using a mechanism that was without an appropriate legal basis. And that's according to a leaked letter from Fiona Caldicott, who's the National Data Guardian, to Stephen Powis, the medical director at London's Royal Free Hospital. Caldicott says that the way that the records were transferred from the hospital to DeepMind didn't comply with the idea of implied consent. And the letter says that in order for implied consent to hold, the data must be shared for the purposes of direct care. For instance, if a nurse shares information about a patient with another nurse when she's ending a shift, And the test is whether a patient had a reasonable expectation that the information would be shared. So here is the letter. It is available, I think, through Sky News. You can read the letter in full. But the key point here is, who's right at the center of that? Well, it's Google. So then we come on to this. WikiLeaks has now published documents showing how Google was helping Al-Qaeda in Syria. And this here is one of the documents that they are talking about, and we can zoom in on this, and it's from Google's head of ideas, Jared Cohen, and it's to the Deputy Secretary of State in the United States. And as you can see, it says, "Please keep close hold, but my team is planning to launch a tool on Sunday." This was in 2012, by the way, that will publicly track and map the defections in Syria. And which parts of the government they're coming from. Our logic behind this is that while many people are tracking the atrocities, nobody is visually representing and mapping the defections, which we believe are important in encouraging more to defect and giving confidence to the opposition. Given how hard it is to get information into Syria right now, we're partnering with Al Jazeera, who will take primary ownership over the tool that we have built, track the data, verify it, and broadcast it back into Syria. We've attached a few visuals to show what the tool will look like. Please keep this very close and let me know if there's anything else you think we need to account for or think about before we launch. We believe that this can have an important impact. So what we have here is Google not only treating the data protection like it doesn't exist, Alex, but we now have Google apparently actually getting involved in state operations taking a stand on who should be in government in a particular country, and working directly with mainstream media in order to influence who is in control of or who is the governing a particular country. This is a pretty dangerous precedent in my mind. Don't know what you think about it.
Mike, it's a precedent for Google government, and we've got this now, so we've got hard proof of Google using big data and again partnering with broadcasters, you know, to make a mini soap opera out of it. Look at Ahmed, he's defected from Assad and so on. And this is the model they've got here. We've got it documented in Syria. We have got the Google France saying that they will be assisting, or what successfully they did, assisting the centrist campaign of Macron through information control. And again, as David Ellis was saying last week, and look at the big data people involved, it's not just Google, it's the whole West Coast tech setup, which goes back to the MITRE Corporation and the Anglo-American code breaking effort in the Second World War. These guys are basically, they've been infiltrated and taken over by globalists. It was an association or an effort by many good people during the war and the post-war year. It's been taken over now, and it's not hard then to wrap your head around the fact that Google, especially with its tax breaks with Cameron, is doing exactly the same in Britain. Google is not the source of this. It's the platform. It's the means. The deep state is the source of it. A small group of elitists, and they have decided that the Tories are going to run Britain, and that Assad is going to be removed from Syria, and they're going to manipulate perceptions of reality, to use a David Icke phrase, one that I support, even if I don't agree with him on everything. They're going to manipulate perceptions on the ground to fit that. So I do hope the baby boomers and patriots who are otherwise thinking I can only vote Tory can wake up to this and see that precisely because millions of them are predicted to do that, the data can be crunched in the background to bring about aims which are entirely contrary to those voters' wishes. You know, clamping down on the pederasty and stopping Brexit and promoting EU military unification and infiltrating globalist agendas. So it's done through these days through technology. And Google is a very important means of that, one that we can't avoid in our lives. Very few people do without Google products in any form in the West now, and increasingly in the Middle East and Africa too. So it's not that we can't live, not that we can live without this technology. We have to have it now, but we have to use our minds and keep them switched on about this.
Alex, thank you very much for that. In that particular synopsis you've given, I'd also just mention our old friends BBC Media Action, because the charity embedded in Syria was boasting that it was helping to destabilise the Syrian government. And of course, we see very close links between the BBC and Google. So this is very widespread manipulation of the political field, as Mike suggested. You've touched on artificial intelligence as well. What is the position of the human being? Well, we think that there's a very dark attack going on against human beings at the moment. Yesterday, we mentioned so-called gender neutrality, and we picked up on this. This is Highgate School that had decided that they were being too binary in the way they're looking at boys and girls. So they were proposing that really anything went, and if boys wanted to be called girls' names or wear skirts, then that was quite normal. Well, you touched also on the NHS. What's the NHS been up to? Exactly the same thing, because here's NHS Choices heavily promoting NHS gender identity clinics. And what's interesting in this article is if you dig in a little deeper, up comes our old friend, the Tavistock Institute. So we've got Tavistock and Portman NHS Foundation Trust. They're running gender identity clinics. But the overall message coming out very strongly here is, well, it's not really the case that there are men and women. There's a multitude of different versions, some of them undiscovered as yet. I think this is a massive attack on conventional heterosexual relationships and stable families to bring up children. So this is very dangerous. And I will also say, I think that many people, particularly in the gay community, are being drawn in and used as a political weapon. On it goes. We've got the Metro, and now we've got a police force. I think this is Suffolk or Norfolk. Northamptonshire, okay, thank you for that. So police force ditches traditional hats, but here's the words, gender neutral baseball caps. And what is interesting in this article is we find another embedded video. So this is how strong the propaganda is. And this is an HSBC embedded video where Stuart Barrett is leading the HSBC project, which is HSBC Pride Network, where he is talking about the need to get rid of what they call MX titles, Ms. or Mr. or Mrs., because that's just not sufficient. We're going to need 10 new gender-neutral titles. So I'm not quite sure what the plus is when we talk about LGBT plus, but 10 is not enough to cover it. There's going to be more variations. And then, of course, we get the charities coming in. This is one particular charity which is pushing the whole agenda and who is actually funding Educate and Celebrate. We come straight back to the government, the Department of Education, and no surprises, good old BBC with children in need. And I'll just end on this note that we're not the only ones picking up on this. This is an email sent in where a man said, I watched your news yesterday. I find this stuff disturbing, but I was also disturbed that it was beginning to be discussed in my workplace. And he drew our attention to Snopes.
That's right.
Okay. Did Bill Nye say gender is determined by your chromosomes? And what this is apparently supposed to be an accuracy of news check. So it said this statement is false. But what it then got on to is a very complicated dialogue, which if you said, what's the overall line? Well, it's not as simple as just men and just women. I am very, very confident that this is a political attack on society. It was mentioned in a lot of early works, including material which the Soviets warned about. Alex, we're watching the clock closely here, but this is not as simple as men and women have changed and need a bit of help to understand what they are. This appears to be deep socio-political policy.
It is, Brian. Snopes is clearly lying. It set itself up as one of the fact checkers who mediate truth to us now. But you can just do a simple YouTube search for Bill Nye chromosome or chromosome deleted or whatever, and you can find the show in which one of his female presenters on his show in the 90s using fridge magnets shows that chromosomes determine sex before birth. So that's a lie of a fact check. But just while we're here, I mentioned the Bishop of Southwark earlier. The C of E, and particularly its Diocese of Southwark, which is the source of South Bank religion half a century ago, the modernism in the Church of England. The Diocese of Southwark in particular has a huge role to play. All the recent bishops going back to the 60s have been mostly Oxford men and certainly all involved in the sexual revolution. And that's why the Lord Bishop of Southwark is so active in the chamber promoting this. The last two bishops have refused to ordain people who are not happy with modern and postmodern sexuality rhetoric. And I just happened to pick up my parents' parish magazine for 50 years ago here. This is the vicar's letter to the parish in 1967. It is often said that more harm is done to the church by her friends than by her enemies. One could even say that it's the shepherds who offend rather than the sheep. The latest example, this is 1967, is Canon Hugh Montefiore saying that Jesus was probably a homosexual. It can't be long before someone suggests that Jesus was a drug addict. But why must these silly ideas come from the lips of leading churchmen? Is it because they haven't done their homework, etc.? And he ends up by saying, the then Canon Montefiore, it will be interesting to see whether he will get a bishopric as a reward for suggesting this sexual revolution in the church. In the Middle Ages, men were burned at the stake for holding far less outrageous views. Yours sincerely, the vicar. And within 3 years of him writing that, Montefiore did indeed get promoted to the bishopric. So I know a lot of people don't like stomaching this, but the Church of England hierarchy has got definite plans, particularly Southwark. The Bishop of Southwark is also the designated bishop for urban life and faith. They are definitely freezing out anyone in public life, starting with the C of E itself, but then any platform in society. They've appointed themselves the moral guardians of that. They're freezing out anyone who is not happy with the million gender revolution. And the reason for that? Well, divide and rule. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. Okay, look, we'll end with this one. You'll be pleased to know, Alex, that the WannaCry virus, if you want to call it that, the ransomware, has been created by North Korea. It's perfect timing, just as North Korea and, you know, things starting to get a bit of trouble between North Korea and the rest of us, and them launching missiles and whatnot. It has been decided that it was North Korea that produced this ransomware. And who made this decision? Well, it was Neil Mehta, a security researcher at Google, as you do. So he found evidence that suggests that WannaCry ransomware, which has affected 300,000 machines across 150 countries, is linked to state-sponsored hacking group in North Korea, according to this article. What he said is that the code found in the WannaCry malware is the same as first... this is one that first came to light in February, is identical to code that was used in early 2015 in a version of Cantopy, a malicious backdoor developed by the Lazarus Group, which is believed to be a state-sponsored hacking group in North Korea. This has then been backed up by various others, and so this is great. So North Korea is behind it. Well, let's see what else is going on. We've got the Interpol European Regional Conference that's taking place today in Austria, and cybercrime is right at the heart of the agenda. The head of Europol said at the weekend that they are investigating in all directions. We don't speculate and can't confirm where this stuff has come from, but they're working on it, so that's good stuff. He said, however, that they hadn't seen anything like it before, that it was absolutely unprecedented. The global reach is unprecedented. The latest count of over 200,000 victims, 150 countries, and so on. Well, Alex, this is nonsense, because in the year 2000, the I Love You virus came out. That infected over 10% of every PC on the planet. It cost between $5 and $8 billion. To get to in damages to business, and it was an estimated $15 billion on top of that to remove the I Love You virus. So far, what have we got? 200 or 300,000 victims of this out of, what, 283 million Windows PCs on the planet. So this thing is not hugely significant. It's being pumped like crazy in the media for some reason, but in terms of its overall reach and impact, it's not hugely significant compared to what happened 17 years ago. So bearing in mind what I was talking about yesterday, that how the cybersecurity agenda has been pushed so hard by NATO and by governments for about the last 2 or 3 years, this is just a load of hype, it seems to me.
Yes, Mike, someone in the chat box has rightly said the West is sure to collapse under this weight of corruption. And as you outlined there, we've had I Love You, we had Stuxnet, basically because of NSA and the hierarchy above it insisting on backdoors into the world's Microsoft computers. We've had this potential all the while. And if it's been used basically passively to get at uncooperative governments like Iran, people haven't made a squeak about it. But unfortunately, we're much more corrupt than we were even in 2000 or even in 2010. And with the inexorable takeover of Western government and agencies by a criminal syndicate, for that's what they are, the existing technology to flick all the switches on all the computers in the world, or most of them anyway, the Microsoft unprotected ones, that ability is no longer benign or indifferent. It's suddenly malign because it's being used to hold people to ransom. It's American technology in American software. It's got nothing to do with foreign governments. Putin has pointed this out, that if the NSA produces these backdoors, they will be used. The difference is the caliber of people who are now holding those levers. And it's just going to get worse from here because of the criminality of those in government.
Absolutely.
Are we ending at that point? I think we probably should, with an eye on the clock. And what a good point to end, because can we do something, or should we do something? The answer to both those questions is yes. Of course we can do something. The key thing remains exposure. We need more people to be aware of what's actually going on, how things are happening. And that requires all of us to be out talking to friends, neighbours, colleagues, tweeting, emailing, writing letters and phone calls to help them wake up. But we also need to tackle the people involved in the criminality. We feel that at the moment, the Conservatives, desperately frightened that the public can wake up to the sheer scale of criminality inside the Tory party. Alex has already said, do anything but vote Tory. We should be taking the battle right to the politicians during these elections. So don't sit there getting depressed. Dark subjects, start to think about what you can do, because ultimately action conquers fear. That's it from us today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.